So many of you have bumped into me in the hallway or eaten lunch with me, and so you've heard a lot about this. I've been pretty excited over the last few months about some new opportunities experimentally to learn about dark matter in the lab. So that's what I want to tell you about, at least a little bit of detail today. But before I start, I want to step back and just articulate why I think particle physics is at a pretty interesting moment right now. So over in the 20th century, as we've learned what we're made out of, we've walked away with some pretty important lessons. So we've learned that we are built, like us, the stuff in this room, we're built out of fundamental constituents, particles, whose interactions are governed by an elementary, almost simple set of principles, relativity and quantum mechanics. And when you apply these principles in the most general way possible, you arrive at, or you can arrive at, a very predictive framework that we often call the Standard Model that to date predicts an incredible array of natural phenomena. Everything from detailed atomic physics and physics at even larger scales, all the way down to the deepest subatomic physics that we've probed to date in very high energy collisions at the LHC. So we can take this very principled and predictive framework and apply it also to obtain very powerful insight about the origin of the universe and its evolution on cosmic time, over cosmic time. Now, this has placed in very, very, very sharp focus the breathtaking fact that most of the universe is built out of something entirely different. Okay? It's brought it into very sharp focus. So there's two key problems in particle physics going forward. One is to understand the Standard Model that I just described, its principles, its structure in greater detail. The other is to figure out what the majority of the rest of the universe is made out of. And there's no reason to think at this time that the process of figuring out what the fundamental matter of the rest of the universe is will not shed just as much insight and light on fundamental physics as the process of understanding what we were made out of did. Okay? So what we've learned is that nature has a dark sector. Sometimes we refer to this as just dark matter. Saying that it's just dark matter almost sends the message that we know more than we actually do about it. There could be more than just matter. There could be new fundamental forces. There could be unstable forms of matter. We just don't know. Everything we do know about it is derived from measurements of its properties based on its influence on us via gravity. Okay? So we know something from measurements of the power spectrum and large-scale structure about its distribution and evolution in the early universe. We can infer its presence and distribution from rotation curves and gravitational lensing. And we've learned that most of the dark matter out there does not have really strong interactions from observations of things like cluster collisions. So going forward, if we want, I mean, the key question here going forward is, does the dark sector, does nature's dark sector interact with us non-gravitationally? This is kind of the obvious question going forward. Now, opinions differ on this, but to me, I think one of the best hints that this is indeed the case comes from thinking about how dark matter got there in the first place. Where does it come from? And among the simplest ideas for where dark matter comes from is that at some point in the early hot universe, dark matter came into thermodynamic equilibrium with our matter. Okay, that requires some kind of non-gravitational interaction. And as the universe expanded and cooled, eventually these interactions couldn't keep up, and dark matter fell out of thermodynamic equilibrium. And what we see today is just the thermal relic abundance from that hot early era. Now, the dark matter density today would there in that kind of scenario, that very simple scenario, would tell us something about what kind of interaction strength between the dark sector or dark matter and us is required. If you have a smaller interaction, then dark matter would fall out of thermal equilibrium earlier and you'd have more of it, and conversely. So we know that you get the correct density less than or equal to the correct density for a cross section or an interaction strength larger than 1 over 20 TeV squared. So that suggests a thermal origin for dark matter. If it's a thermal origin for dark matter, a mass in the vicinity of the weak scale. Now, this can be implemented in a number of different ways. One could just have strongly coupled dark matter interacting with us up in the tens of TeV scale. That's one possibility. One could have weakly interacting dark matter in the 100 GeV to a TeV range. But it also works to have loop-level suppressed couplings at the GeV scale, or say two-loop suppressed couplings at the MeV scale. Okay? So really, as a function of mass, there's an interesting level of coupling strength that would very readily realize this thermal scenario. Now, why do I highlight for this talk MeV to the tens of TeV range? I do that largely because this is where a thermal scenario like the one I just described works very readily. Dark matter could just annihilate directly into standard model fermions, standard model matter, and this is the mass range where the standard model, by and large, lives. So how do we test this idea broadly? So in this talk, I want to go ahead and sharpen what I just said at the level of simple representative scenarios. Before I do that, I want to give just a snapshot of the current search for dark matter more broadly. We've actually had quite a few talks on this recently, so this is going to be lightning fast. And then I'll tell you about some of these experimental efforts and opportunities that have me very excited about the very near future. Okay. So the canonical example of dark matter of thermal origin is something that many people in this room have heard of. It's the so-called weakly interacting massive particle scenario. So this is the case where dark matter has standard model charges. It's just directly charged under SU2 weak forces, so it would interact with the Z boson or the Higgs boson. And in this case, because we know something about those interactions very precisely, we can make pretty clear, not totally unambiguous predictions for the kinds of scattering rates that dark matter of this form would have. And over the last couple of decades, an entire physics program has built up to try to find dark matter of this type scattering off of deep underground detectors. So particles in the halo, dark matter particles in the halo passing through the Earth and then occasionally scattering off of deep underground detectors with a rate given by what we'd expect for a particle carrying SU2 standard model quantum numbers. So this is a very, very busy plot, but it's a very common plot. So what we typically show to represent the strength of these different experiments is we show a WIMP nucleon cross-section on the y-axis, and then we show a mass for the dark matter candidate on the x-axis. So there's a irreducible floor way down here that has to do with neutrino backgrounds. For the most part, this plot's a little bit out of date. The existing sensitivity is in here, and then there's a bunch of projections. Now, one key lesson that we've already learned is that the simplest possibility for a weakly interacting massive particle like the one I just described, namely, one would have elastic scattering through a Z off of ordinary matter, sort of simplest scenario would have that. That was tested long ago, okay? So we know that most of the dark matter does not scatter elastically through the Z if it's in this mass range. Now, there's other possibilities. Dark matter in this mass range could be might interact with the Z, but it might just interact off-diagonally or inelastically. Or it might not have any coupling to the Z, sizable coupling to the Z at all. The dominant coupling could go through the Higgs or loops of Ws, and existing experiments are probing that regime. So the point here is that there's a well-developed set of experiments that have now been, they're in their second or third generation, that are really targeting this WIMP picture and are making very good progress and are approaching a relatively decisive level of sensitivity. Elastic scattering through a Z.
Does it depend on the mass of the dark matter?
Yeah, so it sort of tapers off here around a few GeV, and then it works up to very, very, very high masses. So the sort of milestone for that is way up here. So these lines are sensitivity curves above which one has sensitivity.
I'm saying if you have a much less massive dark matter particle, much less massive MeV, then could that just interact through Z, or?
So let me come back to that, okay. Because there's other issues on the surface of it if you try to go too light.
Okay. Now, the obvious question to ask is, what are we missing? Okay. It's great that we have very powerful experiments, but you don't have to look very hard. So it was already on that previous plot, but the plot was very busy and didn't go very low in mass. So let me show you a different plot, again with dark matter on the x-axis and cross-section on the y-axis. Essentially, all of the direct detection experiments to date lose sensitivity precipitously as the dark matter mass is lowered. And this is really easy to understand. All of these experiments look for energy to be imparted on targets in whatever detector is being used. And as you lower the dark matter mass, these particles are assumed to be moving at virial velocities in the halo, so their kinetic energy drops with the mass, and they can It's very simple. They can impart less energy on the targets. Okay? And around the 10 GeV to few GeV scale, the energy imparted on a big nuclear target is just too small to see, either see or just see above backgrounds. So there's a massive blind spot in this low mass range. OK, now before we get too worked up about this, we really should also ask, is this actually a problem for the science? Yes, there's going to be blind spots, but is this really a big deal? And it's worth pointing out that if all we cared about were WIMPs, particles that only carried weak interaction charges, and that's what set the relic density, et cetera, then the existing direct detection program is actually pretty good. Because if a particle has a relic density set by interactions through Z bosons or the Higgs, as you lower the mass, its cross-section, its annihilation cross-section is going to keep getting smaller to the point where you would just have too small of an annihilation rate and you would have way too much dark matter. Okay? So this upper mass range is motivated from that point of view. The problem, of course, is that we don't know what dark matter is. And this idea of thermal dark matter works over a much broader mass range. Okay? Essentially, over the whole range where the standard model resides, this thermal origin story can work in very, very simple models. In particular, the models where they work readily are ones where dark matter doesn't carry standard model charges. So these go by the name of hidden sectors or dark sectors or hidden valleys, et cetera. Okay? So from this point of view, we really are failing to test the thermal origin idea. And this is part of the reason why I want to focus in the rest of this talk on this lower half of the mass range. Okay? This really represents a frontier for laboratory searches for dark matter, testing this idea of a thermal origin. All right. So now I'm going to need to get very precise so that we can talk quantitatively about data and experiments. Okay? So a little bit of this was hand-wavy. And the way I'm going to do this is I want to build up to some specific representative scenarios that we can then compare existing data to and see where there's problems and opportunities. OK, so let's start with this dark sector idea. So this is just the idea that dark matter is its own sector. The dominant dark matter does not carry standard model charges. It just, you know, might carry new, it might be charged under other forces. We don't know. I'll be totally agnostic about that. The main thing we want to focus on is understanding how we actually probe the allowed interactions that our matter could possibly have with such a dark sector. And there is a fairly simple organizing principle for approaching this problem. And I'm not going to talk about all the interaction types that could be allowed. I want to focus on a small subset. I want to focus on the subset of interactions that have the property that they could be generated by arbitrarily short distance physics and survive to low energy with no suppression from a high mass scale. Okay? So-called marginal operators of dimension 4. So those include the case where new vector particles can mix with our photon, new scalar particles can mix with our Higgs, and new sterile fermions could mix with our neutrinos. Okay? Now there's a wide variety of experiments going after all of these possibilities, and all of them realize thermal origin scenarios over various ranges of mass. I'm not going to be exhaustive. From our point of view, though, and this has become an organizing principle for a lot of the experiments that have developed to go after this physics, is we're not worried so much about the detailed models of what dark sectors look like, et cetera. We're really going after trying to probe these specific interaction types. There's a few of them, so we want to reach an interesting level of sensitivity decisively as soon as we can. And that's really the organizing principle. So now let's look at the landscape of dark matter scenarios here. So again, I don't want to be totally exhaustive, so we're going to focus on the case where we have low-lying spins. So the dark matter candidate in this case could be a scalar or a pseudoscalar, Dirac or Majorana fermion. It could have higher spin, but I want to focus on the scalar or the fermion case. The mediator that mediates interactions could either be a vector, it could be a scalar, a pseudoscalar, could have other spins. But for the low-lying spin case, these two are particularly interesting. So the vector case, this could be a traditional Z prime, that's sometimes discussed in the context of high, you know, people talk about searches for new forces at very high mass. They often are called Z primes in that case. The LHC is actively looking for such forces. At lower mass, some of the better motivated scenarios are the case where you have it can still be called a Z prime, but it's called a dark photon that mixes with our photon. So this is a scenario that I'm going to certainly come back to because this works over a very, very large range of mass. The other very interesting possibility is the case where the mediator is a scalar or a pseudoscalar. This is a fantastic story. It turns out, though, it is very, very tightly constrained by rare meson decays, and many people in this room have worked on this, and it's really a topic for another talk. So I'm going to focus on vector mediators and scalar fermion dark matter candidates, just to get a snapshot of what things look like. So here's the simple representative scenario to have in mind, okay? Dark QED, very simple model. So we have a dark matter candidate chi, it's a fermion here, with mass m chi, interacting with a vector called an a prime with a mass term, mixing with our photon via this vector portal, or kinetic mixing. Now, it's worth pointing out that this kinetic mixing term, not only could it be small, but actually, if the standard model were embedded in a grand unified theory, a larger gauge group, then this operator would have to be very small at low energy, okay? Because essentially, it would be sensitive to gut breaking. And so if, for example, gut breaking occurs at a loop level, then you would expect this operator to be generated at, say, two-loop level, okay? So in many scenarios, especially ones where the standard model gauge groups are unified at some scale, you would even naturally expect this to be small. Now, the dark matter doesn't have to be a fermion. It could be a scalar. So in that case, I'll call the particle phi. OK, so these are just representative toy models so that we can get an idea of what current data looks like. And to really simplify the discussion, I want to work in the limit where the dark matter candidate is lighter than the mediator. So in this case, the physics is fairly straightforward to understand. The dark matter candidate scatters off of standard model charge particles through the exchange of that mediator. So there'll be a mixing term, epsilon, right in there. And either scattering or annihilation into charged particles will be determined by some combination of couplings. Some dark coupling with the mediator, a mixing term, that's the fine structure constant, we know what that is. And then there's some kinematic factors. Now, we don't need, nor should we care that much, what all these individual numbers are. What matters from the point of view of asking about a thermal origin and reaching an interesting level of sensitivity is just looking at the combination, the dimensionless combination of parameters that gives you the right relic density as a function of mass, okay? So this might seem a little confusing at first, but it's not so bad. Essentially, I just want to plot on the y-axis the dimensionless combination of parameters from these toy models as a function of dark matter mass, so that in an invariant way, I can put up a target that corresponds to the strength where you'd get the right thermal relic density. Okay? And this really is a line on these plots in the regime that we're working in. And then what I want to do is I just want to ask, when we look at existing data, does existing data have anything interesting to say about thermal origin scenarios that are living on these lines or above them over this mass range? Okay. Now, there's a wide variety of data, and I'm not going to go through all of it. I'm going to just sort of summarize the most important data. So some of the most important data comes from measurements of the power spectrum of the CMB. It comes from direct detection, high-energy colliders. These are the better-known sources of data. The less known but very powerful sources can come from low-energy colliders, fixed-target experiments, and so on. But let's start with the CMB. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to tell you a little bit about how the physics works from each of these measurements and how it actually constrains dark matter physics. And then I'll show summary plots. So measurements of the CMB power spectrum actually very powerfully constrain or tell us something about low mass dark matter. And that's because, you know, I told you that for a thermal origin scenario, dark matter at some point would thermally decouple from the standard model, and then you'd be left with a relic abundance. And that just means that a typical dark matter particle is no longer going to find an antiparticle to annihilate with over the course of the age of the universe. But that doesn't mean that annihilation stopped completely. You're still going to have residual annihilation. Some small fraction is going to annihilate. And so at the time when atoms are forming, okay, and this is when the essentially electrons are combining with protons, at that time, residual annihilations of dark matter, if they inject electromagnetic energy, can disrupt the ionization fraction of the universe and disrupt the profile of that process, of that recombination process, as a function of redshift. That distorts the CMB power spectrum. So precise measurements of the CMB power spectrum, especially at high L modes, constrains the injection of electromagnetic energy from dark matter annihilations at the time of recombination. Okay? So that's pretty cool, and it's pretty powerful, and I'll show that to you in just a second. Now, I already mentioned direct detection at the beginning, and this is a well-known technique. But I also mentioned that it doesn't work if you use nuclear targets. Well, you can cheat, and you can use, it's not cheating, it's just being clever. You can use electrons, because of course all these big targets, they have a big fat nucleus in them typically, but they also are surrounded by electrons. So one can use electron scattering. That's been done in analyses of xenon 10 data. And that also has something interesting to say about low mass. The reason that works at lower mass, by the way, is just that if you have the reason the energy transfer was reducing as we lowered the dark matter mass is that the energy transfer is controlled by the reduced mass. So as soon as the dark matter is lighter than a big nuclear target, the reduced mass basically is the dark matter mass, and that's just lowering and lowering and lowering. But if you use an electron as a target, the reduced mass will be set by the electron, okay? And I'm not saying this correctly. There's a suppression of the ratio of masses of the dark matter compared to the nuclear target that suppresses the energy transfer, whereas if you use an electron, you don't have that suppression. Okay? So you can more efficiently transfer energy to a light target as you lower the mass. So this is when the dust settles, this is what it looks like. So this is for the case of scalar dark matter. So again, this is the dimensionless strength that allows us to put a relic density line on the plot as a function of mass. Now for this case, there's a CMB line up here, okay? And the xenon 10 analysis of electron scattering is here. And there's one thing I should say about this plot. When I put these two constraints on the plot, I'm calculating them assuming that this dark matter candidate is all the dark matter, and it has a density of the type that we've measured. The reason I'm saying that you should be a little careful is that actually if you go above the blue line here within these models, you would actually have a dark matter would be subdominant. It would have a density less than what we observe. So there's a little bit of a cheat, okay? I'm trying to illustrate how powerful these experimental techniques are compared to the relic density line, but in reality, they wouldn't be situated on the plot like this if this was literally how the universe worked. Okay. Now, there's other types of data, though, that don't care about that kind of detail. So let's go into those. And those come from colliders. Now, there's familiar searches for dark matter that people talk about all the time from the Large Hadron Collider. These are searches where you look for dark matter to be produced in association with jets or photons. Similarly, at low energy colliders, one can look for processes where you have, for example, electron and positrons annihilating in a collider, producing dark matter pairs that recoil off of a visible photon. By measuring the photon, you can then look for the presence of some new state, some new dark matter candidate being produced in the collisions. Such searches from a previous generation of B factories, notably Babar so far, have the best sensitivity for this kind of reaction. In a related way, you don't have to use colliders. You can actually use fixed target experiments. And these can be either from proton beams or electron beams. So there should be either an E or a P up here, okay? The way these work is you take a beam of particles, you slam it into a block of material. In the reactions in the material, you can make dark matter particles. They're weakly interacting, they can get out of the material, and then you can look for them to scatter in a downstream detector. Now, the early work on this was pioneered here at PI by Maxime, Brian Battelle, and collaborators, and they were looking at proton beams at existing facilities, actually existing neutrino factories, okay? And in that case, actually, a lot of the dark matter production comes from meson production and decay. And the best sensitivity to date for low-mass dark matter actually comes from LSND, which was a neutrino experiment using a proton beam and looking at electron scattering. Now, to put these experiments on a plot, we have to do, just bear with me here, we have to do just a little bit of arithmetic. This is not hard. All these reactions, so let's just take the E plus E minus collider reactions as an example. These production reactions for dark matter, they don't depend on the variable that we were looking at before for quantifying the thermal relic density, right? The dimensionless combination that we were plotting was this combination. But collider production just depends on the mixing squared over the beam energy. So okay, fine. So we can rewrite that as a function of the variable we care about, and then we have some unknown quantities. Now, we don't want to overstate the sensitivity of existing data by choosing favorable values of unknown quantities. We could do that. But to be conservative, especially if we're asking the question, are we robustly testing any of these scenarios, we should choose values that are conservative from the point of view of this existing data. So in particular, we want to choose couplings that are on the larger side, because as a function of y, smaller couplings would give colliders more sensitivity relative to other experiments. And we're going to choose mass ratios that are all comparable. In other words, we're not going to have huge hierarchies of mass. From other points of view, that's even the simpler starting point anyway. So when we do that, we can put all the collider data back on this plot and compare to the relic density. And you'll see the E plus E minus colliders, so Babar in particular, sits up here. LHC is up here. LSND, very, very powerful, is down here. And it just barely touches the line right in that mass range. So you see all the existing data, from a conservative point of view, it gets close, but it's not quite there. So in particular, if one really wanted to robustly go after the scalar case, one would need a few orders of magnitude improvement in several places. This could be done. And I'll tell you about how I think this can be done in a second. But let's not like totally focus on one particular scenario. This was scalars. There's also fermions. I should mention that. Yeah. Oh, it's not going to look very wide because there's like an order. I mean, you see this is an order of magnitude right here. Okay. In fact, this plot's a little deceiving because there's multiple orders of magnitude get buried in a tiny amount of space. Now, the simplest case, and remember how I mentioned the simplest case for high mass, weakly interacting massive particle dark matter that elastically scatters through the Z had been tested long ago. So the same kind of simple case of elastic scattering through a vector particle at low mass has also been tested, okay? And the CMB already rules out Dirac fermions that elastically scatter through the vector portal. Okay, now this plot's a little confusing. The way you should read this is that the CMB line is here, and because the relic density line is uniformly above it as a function of mass, the CMB has probed an annihilation rate that would correspond to the relic density over the whole range of mass.
How much above the GeV?
Yeah, so these cross up here in the few GeV range. Okay. Why aren't we?
Yeah.
No, we can. But there's other techniques that start to take over out here. I mean, whether I cut this off at a few or five doesn't matter.
Is it ruled out above a GeV or not?
No.
It's not.
Okay. No. Okay.
But one shouldn't stop there, okay? That's for Dirac fermions elastically scattering through a vector mediator. Of course, you could have other types of fermions. You could have more Majorana-like fermions, okay? Now just a single two-component Majorana fermion is not going to have an elastic coupling to a vector particle like this. But you could have a Dirac fermion where the global symmetry that would normally make the two Majorana-like states degenerate broken, okay? In that case, a Dirac fermion just splits into a pair of Majorana-like states with a mass splitting delta, and the vector coupling is off diagonal. Okay, so this goes by many names, pseudo-Dirac scenarios, inelastic scenarios, and so on. It totally changes the early universe phenomenology. So experiments like the CMB or direct detection can very quickly lose sensitivity to these scenarios. Actually, in the interest of time, I won't explain this. I want to highlight the direct detection issue, though. The issue here is that if you have a splitting and the coupling is off diagonal, and you have a slow-moving particle coming through, it has to then upscatter off the nuclear target. And if that splitting is larger than the kinetic energy of the particle coming in the first place, then it can't upscatter, and direct detection loses sensitivity. Okay? So the splitting only has to be larger than, say, one part in a million compared to the mass for this to really become an important effect at tree level. So these scenarios are completely nightmare scenarios from the point of view of traditional direct detection and CMB. Okay, so those are gone from the plot. And the only types of data that are really robust come from colliders. So we still have Babar and LSND up here. So this is one of these cases where there's really orders of magnitude improvement needed to really cover this. Okay, we can go on. I just wanted to give you a picture of scalars versus fermions. There's other scenarios. You could have scenarios where the density is determined by some residual particle-antiparticle asymmetry. Those are so-called asymmetric dark matter scenarios and others. I'm not going to discuss those in this talk, though. Okay, that's for the mass ratio where the dark matter is underneath the mediator mass. So why did I start there? I started there. Itai, do you have a question?
Why does it go away?
No. What is that constraint again? So this is just...
That's just the residual annihilation. Residual annihilations that occur. They occur very infrequently. At the time of recombination, they're injecting electromagnetic energy.
And when you have a splitting, you just don't have the annihilation because
the heavier state's getting actually depleted long before you got to recombination.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So in the other case, the mediator, if it's lighter than the dark matter mass, that totally changes the phenomenology. So now in that case, the dark matter candidate would annihilate into mediator pairs. Okay? Now that's fine. Except the CMB has probed this incredibly well. Okay? So if this is what's going on, the CMB largely constrains this for both the scalar and the fermion cases. Asymmetric cases can still work, but that's why I'm not going to talk about this. Now I want to make sure we have good coverage to the case where the masses are comparable. And so one unfortunately has to pay attention to some, small details, but they're actually important for actually detecting any of these things. So that is if the mediator is heavier, but not a lot heavier. So it's less than twice the mass, but heavier than the dark matter candidate. In that case, all of the thermal relic density business, that's all the same. But the accelerator physics changes. So now if you produce a mediator in a collider, it doesn't decay into dark matter particle pairs. It decays back to the standard model. Okay. Also, you can still produce dark matter, but you have to produce it first by making an off-shell mediator and then making the dark matter pair. So it changes things quite a bit. Now, fortunately, there's a range of experiments that are being brought to bear looking for new forces. So I'm calling these direct mediator searches. So these include the LHC. They include a whole generation of experiments that studied flavor, some of which I already mentioned, Babar in particular. And so these experiments, for example, can look for mediators by looking for electron-positron collisions. And you can produce a mediator, and then you can look for it when it decays into standard model final states. Okay? In fact, these searches are not unlike the kinds of searches that were done at the LHC to discover the Higgs. One could do the exact same thing with fixed target experiments. And that's being done at Jefferson Lab and in Germany and elsewhere. And again, to put these on the plot, we have to rewrite all the cross sections as a function of this dimensionless strength that determines the relic density, and then we make conservative assumptions. And we can make plots like this. This shaded region here, this is all the existing data. So this is a field where the experiments looking for new forces have really covered a lot of ground. Okay? So there's actually very, very powerful data that goes down to incredibly small couplings for new forces in the low mass range. Then it tapers off up here. The relic density line sits there.
Sorry, where is the limit? Is it to the left or to the right or up or down?
This stuff is all probed.
The
shading is not showing up on the screen here very well, but it's shaded in here. This is supposed to be white. Looks the same to my eye, though. Oh, well, it looks great on my screen, but okay. Okay. So there's a lot of room to really decisively probe. And these are just representative scenarios, but they actually give you a pretty good idea of what you have to do to actually test thermal dark matter over this whole mass range. There's a ways to go is kind of the punchline here. Now, an effort to try to close the gap has really triggered a serious renaissance in experimental activity using a wide variety of techniques. Okay, so high-energy colliders, high-intensity colliders, fixed-target machines, all sorts of small-scale experiments, really a range of activity. Okay? Now, the punchline of this talk, and I want to put this slide in here now, okay, before I go over time and all of that, is that there's a collection of experiments that, with respect to the sensitivity needed to probe thermal relic sensitivity, can get there. Okay? It's not one experiment. In usually most cases, it's a couple. I'm going to explain these lines in a few slides. But this is really the takeaway point of this talk. There's a set of small-scale experiments that can pretty decisively probe these simple thermal relic scenarios. over pretty much the entire range of mass underneath the UGEV.
And these are all things where it's independent of whether it's actually making up the thermal density. It's not like where you said this xenon.
There's a mix of things in here. So for the accelerator techniques, it does not care at all about whether or not. Okay. It's totally insensitive to what fraction of the dark matter. Okay. So the techniques that are going to make a lot of progress in this direction, okay, so two of them I mentioned already. Well, a few of them I mentioned. There's low threshold direct detection. There's future very, very high intensity E plus E minus collider studies. And then these three that I'm going to say a bit more about in detail because I'm very actively involved with them. Okay. Now, actually, it's awesome to be in Canada so close to SNOWLAB because SNOWLAB is going to host some of the most powerful dark matter direct detection experiments ever over the coming years. So Super CDMS operates in a very clean environment with very low backgrounds. It's going to be a large exposure direct detection experiment. He's left by now. But anyway, DiStefano actually gave a talk yesterday. He was here at PI telling us about this. But Super CDMS can operate to lower energy thresholds than a lot of these other experiments that I showed you earlier. And so they're actually going to be able to carry this direct detection effort down into lower mass. So that's one technique. Another will come from Bell 2 in Japan. So that's an E plus E minus collider that operates with an incredibly high intensity. They're going to take more than a couple orders of magnitude more data than any of the previous generation of such experiments. And on the sort of 2020 timescale, they're going to improve sensitivity to reactions like dark matter plus a photon. This is provided they get their trigger working. But they're going to improve sensitivity by more than an order of magnitude. Okay. Then there's the direct mediator searches. And there's way too much to talk about on this front. But these include their searches at the LHC, their searches from B factories, and on the lower mass range, there's fixed target searches. So the fixed target searches have tremendous powerful, they're incredibly powerful because they're incredibly high luminosity. So one of the early simplest experiments of this type is APEX. So this uses a very high intensity electron beam at an existing facility, Jefferson Lab, with existing equipment in Hall A, so basically two spectrometers. So you send in an electron beam, you hit a target, you can produce any mediators that might exist, they decay back to E plus E minus, you then look for the E plus E minus pairs in the spectrometers, and you do a resonance search. It's very simple, okay? Just very high intensity. So Natalia and I are co-spokespeople on this, along with colleagues at Stony Brook, so Ruben and Bogdan, who's at JLab. And this has been a pretty transformative experience for me. Okay. So it was actually doing APEX where I think my eyes have been open to this tremendous array of very powerful technologies that have been developed by the nuclear physicists, so you know, outside of high energy physics over the last 10 or 20 years. A huge array of detector technologies, accelerator technologies that can be brought to bear on dark matter physics. So it was seriously eye-opening to me. So maybe I should say a few things. So I mean, actually, this is a picture of our target for APEX. We're a little too happy in these pictures. I think I've shown this before. So I like to say that I literally pulled strings to make this experiment happen. I think I've shown this picture before. It's funny. There's all this very, very sophisticated equipment in Hall A at Jefferson Lab, okay? But when it comes time to calibrate the magnetic optics, you physically walk down into the hall, and you pick up these strings to move a little calibration plate in and out of the beam line, okay? Anyway, I love that. I was seriously wondering what I was doing here when I was doing that. Yeah. Well, it's now they're going to have some fancy motorized. Anyway, it's actually changed. Say again. Oh, I know. Well, you know why? This is actually right behind the target, and so this area gets just bathed in radiation. And so if you try to put electronics there, it can very easily break. Anyway, okay. So another experiment. Another experiment that I proposed and have been involved with from the beginning is HPS. So now this uses the same technique as APEX, but then another trick as well. So for very, very small couplings, if you make any new mediators, they can travel some distance before they decay. So there can be a so-called displaced vertex. So if you can very precisely track the decay products, you can reconstruct where the decay happened, and you can see if it's separated from the target. So the way this is done is there's a very forward-oriented tracking device. And this tracking device just consists of layers of silicon. So basically, silicon allows you, if you have a charged particle hitting silicon, you can very precisely tell where it hits, and you can reconstruct a track. This is a technique that's been used for a decade or more by the high energy physics world. It's actually just now working its way into use in this context. So then you take a tracker with a layer above and below. So this is a picture of the front face above and below. And then actually these close up right around the beam. So this actually gets very, very close. It gets to within about half a millimeter of the beam. So there's this insanely high intensity beam. If it actually hits either one of these things, it'll totally fry this device. But it's very precisely controlled. It's been constructed. So actually last January, I was at a collaboration meeting and we got a chance to see this. It was kind of hectic for the tracking folks. They were actually finishing up the construction. You can see the front face poking through right there. It's being wrapped up in foil and then it was put in a box and then shipped off to JLab. Yeah, that's Gordon in the picture as well. Well, a bunch of us were there for a workshop, and we got a chance to see this thing before it was packed off to JLab. So I was there a few weeks ago. HPS is taking data right now, so I was pretty lucky. I don't know if being on an owl shift counts as being lucky, but it was about 3 a.m, and we finally got this tracker working. And so at this point, HPS has been able to take science quality data for a little over a week, and it will continue taking data this spring. Okay, so moving on. One can, in addition to looking for mediators, just look for the dark matter directly itself. Okay? So I mentioned beam dumps before, and there's a lot of activity here as well. I probably will say a little bit less. So there's existing proton beams and neutrino facilities. One such existing facility is at Fermilab, and using Miniboon, which is a neutrino detector. They took data in a mode of operation where they were able to put their proton beam directly on their dump, so that they actually have a very specially built target because they actually try to make neutrinos. But the problem is that if you make too many neutrinos, the neutrinos can scatter in your experiment and look just like dark matter particles scattering. Okay, so they actually have a couple of tricks they've employed to lower their background rate. So they took data last year, are analyzing it now. They actually just presented at APS, but I didn't quite see a preliminary result. But I think it's actually on the way. It's very close. You probably know. In parallel, okay, so the issue with proton beams is they make neutrinos. So the future of beam dump searches for dark matter, we'll see a lot of growth using electron beams, because when electrons hit a block of material, they make far fewer neutrinos than when a proton hits a block of material. Okay? So there's very low backgrounds from neutrinos, and in electron collisions, when you make dark matter or the mediators, they go really forward. So you get a very collimated beam of particles, of secondary dark matter particles. That means you can put a detector very close to the dump, and because it's close, you can make it small and still have good geometric coverage. Okay. And so actually, we were able to go back and just looked at previous data from a generation of beam dump experiments that were looking at millicharge particles and axions, just to verify that the kinds of backgrounds we expect are there are indeed there, and that this approach is not hopelessly doomed, and it looks very good. Okay. And so a collaboration has developed to carry out an experiment at very high intensity electron beams, the BDX experiment. So two of the co-spokespeople are postdocs here, so Eder and Gordon, who I think are both in the audience. A full proposal development is underway. This experiment's going to have an interesting birth. So this is going to be done in a couple of stages on different continents. So there's actually a first phase that's being looked at in Frascati, where a good fraction of the collaborators are based. They're actually based in Italy. And then a second phase and a higher luminosity phase would eventually be carried out at JLab. Okay? So in particular, this experiment would be situated here. So fortunately, this showed up. So I haven't shown a picture of this, but this is Jefferson Lab. Okay? So an aerial view. So basically, there's a beam that runs around in a circle here. It's accelerated each time it runs around, and then it's passed through here, and it's split into three different pathways. So one pathway goes here. That's Hall A. So Apex is situated right in there. Okay, and then that beam hits a dump, which is actually right here, and it stops the beam. And what we want to do is put BDX back here in this kind of trash yard. There's just a bunch of crap sitting on the surface here. But there's a nice space to dig a hole about 10 meters down and put a very small detector. Okay. Actually, if you look a little bit further back, there's this Confederate flag flying RV park right back here. But anyway, so then another fraction of the beam goes this way, and it hits Hall B. Hall B is right there, and HPS is situated in a little alcove right there, obviously underground. Okay, So I showed you HPS. Now the final experiment that I want to tell you about, I think we might put it, we might want to put it here. Okay, this is hall C. It's another general purpose high luminosity hall, but the technique that we want to pursue uses missing momentum in a fixed target collision. So the way this works is uses the same production process in an electron beam that you would have in a beam dump. Okay, so electron comes in, it hits a nucleus, you can make a dark matter particle pair. Now what's kind of distinctive is you have a very soft recoiling electron. And in a beam dump experiment, you never see that soft recoiling electron, okay, because it's happening in the dump, there's all this other junk going on, you can't see it. But suppose you actually sent in one electron at a time so that you could see that recoiling electron and measure its energy. Then you could actually infer how much momentum was being pumped into the forward direction. And you can look back here and see if any of that energy and momentum is showing up, okay? Now, if you can do that reliably, this approach can be very powerful compared to, say, beam dumps. Because a beam dump needed the production of dark matter and the rescattering of dark matter. So you need two small things to happen. This just needs one. So I'm going to summarize how this works at the very end of the talk, because this is something I'm actively involved in right now. And we'll spend probably the summer trying to get off the ground into a proposal phase. But when you put all of these techniques together, so I showed you this plot earlier, this is what the situation looks like. So these very high intensity B factory Bell 2 E plus E minus colliders in Japan, 2020, this is kind of the, this is where it's coming in, purple line up here. Beam dump opportunities, so there's actually, there's JLab in here. There's actually a very high, high luminosity, I don't think really realistic with the existing equipment, but potentially an interesting option at Cornell on there. These red lines are the missing momentum approach, where the dotted line, this is the line at which you start encountering some very problematic backgrounds. So I'm calling it kind of an a kind of limiting factor. And then with existing accelerators and technology, there's two scenarios for experiments shown there. That was for the fermion case. This is for the scalar case. And the point is that also on this plot, we have direct detection coming back, okay? Because there's an elastic channel here, so direct detection can work. So most of the direct detection experiments taper off way up here. The low threshold super CDMS is getting down into close to half a GeV. So there's really an opportunity here to reach an interesting level of sensitivity across essentially the entire mass range for a wide variety of scenarios, okay? Essentially the simplest scenarios that work. Likewise, for different kinematic range, this is the range where you flip the hierarchy in mass. The visible mediator searches cut into this very nicely. Okay. So I want to go back. Another way of representing this is back on this mass axis, okay, where before we just had direct detection. Now I want to bring back, you know, and acknowledge that there's LHC efforts underway trying to find dark matter and new forces in the higher mass range. I didn't mention invisible Z and H before, but they play an important role for probing lower mass WIMPs and then direct mediator searches. So direct detection, so what flagship experiments are actually needed to really fill this in? So direct detection is going to be extended a little bit at SNOLAB. That's going to make some important threshold advances. If there was one experiment to be carried out to fill in the remainder, it would be fixed target missing momentum. This is the one that can really close the gap from the upper mass range where direct detection is coming down, going all the way down to the lowest masses possible. I cut it off in an MEV, but this technique works as low in mass as you would like, okay? So the cutoff at an MEV for this technique was a bit artificial. Now there are some scenarios for which direct detection doesn't work. So it's good that we also have Bell 2 coming in here, because there's that offers more robust coverage in this intermediate range. And then beam dumps likewise cover a small number of scenarios that fixed target missing momentum can have difficulty covering. Now some of these efforts are very mature. I would definitely describe low threshold direct detection as a mature kind of adult effort, okay? Whereas I think the efforts at, say, the B factories, and also maybe this is unfair with the beam dumps, maybe it's a little more adolescent, okay? The baby in town is definitely fixed target missing momentum. This is an approach where there's really not a basis for comparison in past experiments, okay? So a lot of kind of basic R&D has to be done to get this off the ground. But I want to try to explain why this can work, why it's a little bit tricky, and why it's only happening now, as opposed to a long time ago, actually, because it's actually a really, really simple idea. So remember the idea. The idea is you just electron scatters off a nucleus. So that's the Coulomb photon of a nucleus. And then you just throw off a dark matter pair. The dark matter pair carries away most of the momentum, and the recoiling electron is soft. So the event would look like you see an electron coming in. You use a, you know its energy. You use a little tracker to determine its direction. It scatters, and then you see a soft recoiling electron whose direction you reconstruct. Okay? So that's a pretty dramatic signal. And you don't see anything else down in here. Now, most of the time, what will happen is an electron will come in, and it won't produce a dark matter pair. It'll produce a photon, right? Like photons will be kicked off in the process of these collisions. Okay? Now, you don't see the photon in the tracker. The photon will go through, and then it interacts in any calorimeter material you put back there. Okay? So far, so good. You can see all the energy that photons put into a calorimeter because they very quickly convert into charged particles, and you get a big explosion of particles that you can see. All right? So you can, so when you put energy into the forward direction, you'll see it, as opposed to dark matter, where it'll just, where you won't have anything happening in here. You can actually use tracking technology not unlike what's being used at high energy experiments or HPS to do the tracking both before and after. Okay, so it's really, really simple. So why is this only being thought about now? And it's basically because there's actually some unusual requirements from the accelerator point of view, from a background point of view, and it wasn't really thought how to kind of make complete use of this pretty distinctive kinematics where you have, you know, an electron coming in, and then you have a reaction, and you have a really soft electron coming out. It's really simple to say, but it was overlooked how to use that kinematics to actually mount an experiment that would have plausible sensitivity. Okay, so how much luminosity do you need to do an experiment like this at an interesting level? Sorry, I'm going to answer a lot of these questions. Yeah, if it's a why was it so hard, let me continue. So, so how many electrons do you have to put on a target to have a decisive experiment? So an experiment like this gets interesting after you have about 10 to the 12 electrons on a target. It gets pretty good around 10 to the 14, and it gets pretty awesome around 10 to the 16. Now, these are not big numbers, okay? In fact, APEX, the experiment I showed you, puts 10 to the 16 electrons on a target every few seconds, okay? So these are not big numbers. And in fact, in collider experiments, numbers on the order of 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 are routinely put on, you know, are collided into one another in any reasonable time scale. So how is it that these small numbers could be beating the pants off of colliders up here, okay? Well, I mean, so luminosity is not number. This is easy to understand kind of, well, I don't know if this is intuitive, but factually, if we compare fixed target versus colliders, the thing to know is that at a collider, we take packets of large numbers of particles and then we throw them at each other. And if we make these packets really small and we're lucky, we'll get a few hard scatterings every time we do that, okay? Whereas in fixed target, if you throw an electron at a block of material, well, it's a block of material. You're going to get a hard scattering, okay? So small numbers of electrons in a fixed target setting can still give you comparable luminosities to colliders. Just because you have a small number of particles compared to colliders doesn't mean the luminosities are low. But that's just comparable. What really makes this fixed target approach work is that the production cross-section is huge by comparison to E plus E minus colliders. So when you make a dark matter pair, it's initiated by a scattering off the Coulomb photon of a nucleus. And over pretty much this whole GeV mass range, the Coulomb photon can be very, very soft and still initiate this process. There's not a huge momentum transfer in here. So you can coherently scatter off the whole nucleus. So that gives you a big Z squared factor. That can be as large as 10 to the 3 for big nuclei. And then on top of that, the production cross-section itself scales like 1 over the mass squared of the thing you're making. That's to be contrasted with colliders, where it's 1 over the beam energy squared. Okay. So yes, there's an extra alpha over here. So you can just take 1 alpha times a z and call that order 1. And so then you basically have a z over m squared compared to 1 over beam energy squared. The smallest beam energies that have typically been used in colliders are around 10 GeV. So over this mass range, you can get up to 10 orders of magnitude larger production rates than you would in colliders. That's really where the extra oomph is coming from, okay? Now, there's a rub, of course, and that is that in order to do this, one has to put 1 electron at a time on a target. Whereas I just told you in colliders, you know, you're throwing huge packets together each time. Well, the problem here is that accelerator beams, they have time structure. Okay? We don't do this just in a totally random way. Beams are prepared in a very orderly, methodical fashion. And you have buckets of particles in a very particular kind of sequence with a particular kind of timing structure. And at the kinds of colliders that I just mentioned, if we dialed down the luminosities so that we could just fire one electron at a time, well, that would only happen at a 100 hertz rate. And so in a reasonable lifetime experiment, you could maybe put 10 to the 9 electrons on a target. Okay? So that's not going to work. Now you could look at the LHC. So the LHC is a bit faster. It puts buckets of particles onto a target at a 40 megahertz rate. That's a little bit more interesting, but still not enough, even if it were electrons. It's protons in this case. The fastest accelerators in the world are used by the nuclear physics community. So they put buckets of particles onto targets at gigahertz rates. Okay? Now we're talking. So if you dial down the current so that it's one electron, you know, Poisson average, per little bucket, okay, then, so that you're firing them on one at a time, then you can start getting into this 10 to the 16 in a year range. Okay? So that would be, so beams like that exist at Jefferson Lab or Mainz in Germany. Another possibility is there are so-called storage rings. These are rings of particles that, sorry, these are, they're rings that hold a beam of particles just going around in a circle. And they can be filled with a very tight time structure. Okay, so you can put bucket after each other, and so they can be recirculating with a 100 megahertz rate going around, and then you can just dribble them out one at a time. So such facilities exist at Cornell, for example. Okay, fine. So suppose we have a beam in hand where it's one electron at a time in a beam on the same spot, nanosecond rate, so we can get our 10 to the 16. Would this actually work? No, it would not work. If we took a simple detector, like the kind that maybe we were looking at for some of these beam dump experiments, the problem you would have is that if one of these rare reactions happened, it would be buried in the several normal reactions that happened before it and after it. Okay? Because it takes time to see things. When an electron collides with material, it initiates a massive shower. That shower spreads out, it evolves. It generates all sorts of secondary photons, protons, neutrons. It takes time for a detector to see that, and you have to read it out. So you can't do this in practice. Now you can slow it down. This would be more realistic for a simple detector, but then the luminosity is not enough. So there's a bit of a, I don't know, a Goldilocks problem. So basically, the solution to this is to find a kind of, there's a sort of perfect middle ground here, or close to optimal middle ground. So you can use, instead of firing them in one at a time at the same spot, you use an intermediate time scale, something like 100 nanoseconds, and you spread the beams out in space. Now, I'm not talking about like millimeter. I'm talking about like 10 or 20 centimeters. So this is an incredibly spread out beam. Okay. Now, they don't literally have to be structured like this. Remember I told you that beams can have nanosecond time scale? So you can separate these out in time and in space. Okay. 30 meters from the opening. That would be the sort of scale you should have in mind. Maybe it, if it was like at Cornell, it would be like 10 meters. But okay. Now, this pushes you in a very particular direction, detector-wise. So it turns out that in order to really exploit this technique of spreading a beam out in space and in time like this, you need to have a detector that can measure particles when they get close to one another. Right? You have big splash of particles in the detector, and then you have a nearby electron and a big splash. You want to be able to get these splashes close to one another and still reconstruct them carefully. So this is a problem that the high energy physics community has been worried about for decades as they keep going to higher and higher luminosity. And they've been working on technologies, not for machines that are currently in use, but for, say, the high luminosity LHC, or for a future international linear collider, or maybe this super collider that's being discussed in China. They're building detectors that have incredible granularity. So you can measure things really close to one another. And that lets us actually, well, centimeter scale, realistically, which is very, very good. So one example of this, there's such a detector. You know, these kinds of detectors are built as prototypes right now. And they're being built as prototypes for these future applications. This is precisely the kind of detector technology that one must have to actually pull off an experiment like this. So course, instead of building something huge, we're talking about something very small. So these are highly granular. They're high speed. Just to give you a flavor for this, they use layers of silicon and tungsten. This is actually pretty cool because the tungsten, that's the so-called converter. What that does is it gets photons to start showering, and then you use the silicon to actually see the charged particles coming out of the showers. So you have silicon, tungsten, the whole, you can actually see these layers in here, okay? So what that gives you is it literally lets you take a photograph of the shower evolving with excellent timing and with excellent granularity, because the silicon, you know, gives you pinpoint precision for where all these particles are going.
But what's the active material? It's probably scintillator, but. Yeah, I should wrap this up. I'm a little over time, apologies. Okay, so that's what's nice about that is if you actually bring a detector technology like that, so basically we're using the fanciest detector technology in existence that's really being designed for high energy physics. We want to use it with nuclear physics beams to do this, okay? So this is what the signal looks like. Remember, this is a typical event. These are the kinds of backgrounds that we're worried about. We're worried about the case where a photon is produced, but instead of making a big shower, it produces a small number of particles when it hits a nucleus, okay? What's beautiful about the kind of detector I just showed you is it's precisely the kind of device that can see these types of particles being produced right next to big showers that are of a more typical variety, okay? So we've done a fairly exhaustive study of the types of reactions like this that are very rare, that can potentially fake a missing momentum signal. Yeah, so there's neutral.
When you strike a nucleus, you can have two neutrons coming up.
Yes. So what you're worried about is striking a nucleus with energetic neutrons coming out that carry almost all of the energy away.
And those rates, there is something known about those rates. Well, in practice, it's listed as a three-neutron reaction. It is what you're saying, though. This is the one. The rate is low enough. So if you're worried about, the one that can carry away a lot of energy, though, is the NN bar production process when you scatter off a nucleon. If you're just softly kicking neutrons out, that's less of a concern.
Well, the process looks like you emit a pion and the nucleus absorbs the same pion and spits another neutron, so you can have
Two energetic neutrons. So the answer to your question, though, is that the big green thing that I was putting in the back end is a hadronic backstop. It's basically designed to see the occasional hard neutrons that carry away most of the energy. Okay, so that's the short answer. All right, I am running a little over time. So the final ingredient that makes an experiment like this possible is by measuring the recoiling electron, you can actually separate. You can actually enhance signal to background by anywhere from 2 to 4 orders of magnitude. Okay, so the way this works is. So the variables I'm looking at the energy fraction of the recoiling electron and the transverse momentum of the recoiling electron. That's transverse momentum, energy fraction. I'm using some funny variables. I'm basically rescaling by transverse momentum squared so that Bremsstrahlung, which initiates all these backgrounds, shows up as flat, whereas signal looks like this. It's peaked way down here, okay? High transverse momentum, soft electron recoil. So you can use this difference to enhance signal by a few orders of magnitude, and even more important than that, you can use this part of the kinematics to actually monitor how well your vetoes are working. This is absolutely crucial to actually have an experiment like this. Okay, so I'm pretty convinced that this is going to be the way forward with low mass thermal dark matter experiments of an interesting type, reaching an interesting level of sensitivity. But really the whole array is required to have a nice, robust, decisive program. There's a lot of activity in this direction. And stay tuned. So I'm looking forward to working on this over the next few months. And as it gets off the ground, a few years, hopefully we'll discover dark matter in the lab. And if we don't, these experiments will be sufficiently decisive that we will have learned something interesting about whether or not dark matter in this broad mass range has a thermal origin or not. Thanks.